The Billboard Hot 100 has been ranking the week's most popular music since 1958. The first song to top the chart was Ricky Nelson's Poor Little Fool. The most recent song to do so is Taylor Swift's The Fate of Ophelia. A lot has changed in the music industry between those two songs, not only in the types of songs that top the charts, but also in how they're promoted and how they're determined. A new book explores the statistics behind the Hot 100, and it's the focus of this episode of Stats and Stories, where we explore the statistics behind the stories and the stories behind the statistics. I'm Rosemary Pennington. Stats and Stories is a production of the American Statistical Association in partnership with Miami University's Departments of Statistics and Media, Journalism, and Film. Joining me, as always, is regular panelist John Baylor, Emeritus Professor of Statistics at Miami University. Our guest today is Chris Dalla Riva. Dalla Riva is a senior product manager at AudioMac, where he focuses on data analytics and personalization. He also writes the newsletter Can't Get Much Higher that explores the intersection of stats and music. Dalla Riva's work's been featured by outlets such as Economist, Business Insider, NPR, as well as Stats and Stories. He's back today to talk about his new book, Uncharted Territory, What the Numbers Tell Us About the Biggest Hit Songs and Ourselves. Chris, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to get into it again today.
What made you decide to write the book?
I actually didn't set out to write a book. It was a weird, circuitous journey where out of college, I was working in economic consulting. So I was already in the stats world. But I've always been involved in music. You know, I've always played in bands. I've always, in high school, I'd write and record songs and make people suffer through them by burning them to CDs. So at the time, like I said, I was working in consulting, and I just came up with this scheme or this idea to listen to every number one hit for really no reason in particular. I was just like, oh, you know, it'll be nice at the end of the day. I'll sit down, listen to one number one song. Maybe my songwriting will become better. But because I have some data experience, I was working in a data field at the time, and I eventually started working in the music industry with data. As I would go along, I would track tons of facts and figures about these songs. I started noticing some patterns, and I felt compelled to write about them. And then there's a long, weird journey about how the book actually got published. But yeah, that's how it started. It was just, I was just listening to these songs for fun. And because I have a data side, I started collecting information and noticed some trends and wanted to write about them.
So how many songs did you end up listening to? And how many years did this span?
Yeah, so Billboard has been around since the late 1800s, and it actually, as the name suggests, it started out as a magazine that would track bill postings or what was being advertised on literal billboards. In the early 1900s, they started getting more into covering like celebrity gossip. And then I think by the 1930s, it was pretty exclusively focused on music. And they would occasionally roll out charts of what was popular, because ultimately it became an industry publication. So, you know, you think people working in the music industry want to know what's selling. They had a bunch of different charts throughout the 1950s, and then in 1958, they launched the Hot 100, which the goal was to combine all sources of listening. So back then it was sales, radio, and jukeboxes to try to figure out what was the true most popular song in a given week in America. So the first number one hit was Ricky Nelson's Poor Little Fool on August 4th, 1958, and there has been a new chart published every week. Most songs are number one for a couple weeks. So there have been, I think at this point, about 1,200 number one hits. When I, of course, had to stop listening at some point to publish the book, though it gets pretty close to the present. So I was a little bit under 1,200. And I was doing one song a day. So I think if you do the math, it takes a little bit over 3 years to get through all of those songs. And I was pretty consistent. I'm sure I missed a day here and there, but it took a little over 3 years of listening, and then actually getting it published took many more years.
Well, first I want to say how much I've enjoyed reading your book. I mean, it's been a lot of fun.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
I like even the way that you've framed this, and it seems so the way that it looks like you have this history, culture, technology component, then highlights, lowlights, arguments, stoppers, odds and ends, and then everything else. So you package that in each of the chapters, and the chapters were eras. How did you decide kind of eras? And then ultimately, how could you what variables did you have to add to be able to think about highlights, lowlights, and argument starters?
Yeah, so I'll start with the eras question, where I just call each chapter, okay, this is an era of music. And what I talk about is there is an arbitrary nature to the way I define these eras. Because I was ultimately working on a book, I would stop listening and start writing, or define the end of an era when I thought that I had enough material to write about. So there was a utilitarian nature to how I was defining eras. But something I talk about in the book is that, we often think of music as decades, like 60s music or 70s music. But of course, history doesn't stop and start on January 1st at the beginning of a new decade. So I didn't want to adhere to strict timelines like that. I wanted to have flexibility to be like, all right, there are musical trends that started in 1968 and ran through 1974 or what have you. So I was really using my ears there and the idea that, I had to stop and write every once in a while to be like, okay, this is the first quote era that I'm going to write about. So there's some internal logic there. There is some arbitrariness, but I think no matter where you start and stop, there's always going to be an arbitrary nature. And as you note, at the end of every chapter or at the end of each era, I would mark the best, worst songs from that era, along with argument starters or things people disagreed upon and some other songs that I wanted to highlight. A, the way I did this was not super sophisticated. I had three people listen to every song, and I would make them rate it out of 10, and I would average the ratings, and whatever was the highest, whatever was the lowest would get highlighted at the end of each chapter. Whichever had the greatest variation in ratings, I would call an argument starter, and I would talk about that. And the reason I did this was, A, I wanted to highlight that there is a subjective nature to what we think about music, but I think it's very important for us to try to quantify our feelings, because even if you don't believe that there is a true way to define what's great and what's not, everyone has opinions on which songs they like and which songs they don't. And I think it's fun to talk about those things. And often, even when I disagree with people, it makes the music come to life when you start talking about why you disagree or trying to understand what your feelings are. So I wanted to embed that into at the end of each chapter, A, because it's a little fun. But B, that was initially how this data started. I was tracking just how people I was asking were rating these songs, and then slowly it blew out into all these other things I was tracking. But because that was the beginning, I thought it was a fun thing to tack on to the end of each chapter, and I thought it sort of centered things where, you knew you could go to the end of every chapter and you could see a couple songs and maybe listen to them if you were unfamiliar or not.
You mentioned in the book that two of the raters were consistent throughout this project, but then the third you were rotating through folks. Why'd you decide to do that?
Good question. The two consistent raters were me and a friend of mine who I always just talk music with. And I had mentioned that I was going to listen to all these songs. I was probably only a couple, and he was like, "Oh, I'll do it with you." So it just started as like a friendly thing. Like him and I were just listening to these songs. We text about them. We would rate them, and I would track our ratings. But we have a pretty similar taste, and of course, we would disagree about certain songs. I just thought it would be nice to get a third perspective to try to balance things out a little more. Of course, I could have surveyed 100 people if I had the time or resources, but after a certain point, I didn't want to make it seem like, oh, I was actually uncovering some platonic truth about these songs. At the end of the day, there is a subjective nature to doing this, and I tried to invite people for that third rating who were cognizant of what was going on at the time, whichever songs we were listening to were popular. So, people of my parents' generation, when I was going through the 80s, some older cousins when I was going through the 90s, some of my coworkers when I was going through the 2000s. I think it added a little more depth and perspective than if it were just me and my friend who have somewhat similar taste. But yeah, that's sort of the reason I chose to go about that.
I have a question about, I think, the earliest narrative era that you discussed. So in each chapter, you talk about these narratives that often appear in sort of some of the songs that are charting in your era. And so, like, I was struck because when I was a kid, we would take these long car rides, and my dad would lead us in sing-alongs, because what are you going to do with three little kids trapped in a car for like 4 hours, right? And one of the songs we would sing was Tom Dooley, like, every single car road. We love Tom Dooley. We would sing it every single time. And I was much older when I realized what a morbid, strange song that was to be like something we would
Yes.
sing together as a family. And in your discussion of that earliest era, that first era of the top 100, you note that there are all of these narratives around death that are showing up in these songs. What was going on?
Yeah, that was actually what inspired me to start writing, where I got through like about 50 songs. I was like, why are there so many songs about people dying? This is seems like a weird topic to exactly to your point for the top of the pop charts. It just doesn't seem like a popular topic. And I dwell on that in the first chapter. And I think there are a couple things going on here. First, I think it's important to note that those songs, like Tom Dooley, is sort of an old folk song. And there is, going back hundreds of years, musical and literary traditions of these really gruesome narratives. I mean, think of a lot of Shakespeare. There's gruesome death and lovers dying. So in that sense, there is a continuation, but I think there is something very specific to that era. Many of these songs, they call, Tom Dooley's not an example of this, but they call them teenage tragedy songs, where it's like two teens in love, one dies tragically, often in a car crash. And I think when you think of this phenomenon around teenagers, it makes a little bit more sense, because at that time, teenagers were a emerging demographic, which is weird from our current perspective. But previously, it was really like you were a child and then you were an adult. Of course, people lived through 13 to 19, but that wasn't really thought of as a distinct demographic period. But with the rise of compulsory education, there's more money after World War II. You start getting teenagers, this group of people who are like, they're in school all day together, and culture generates around them. And it is a grim topic, but it is often focused on teens. So I think in that sense, it's just connected to the rise of this demographic. But there is a grimness in a lot of things that went on in the early part of the 20th century. You get multiple world wars, pandemics, the Great Depression. And at the same time, you saw lots of young artists and actors dying pretty young. So I think it's sort of a confluence of factors that come together to make this weird, depressing trend that to our contemporary ears seems odd. But as you're saying, people would sing along to these songs. And I think that often also illustrates that for a lot of people, it's about melody and it's not as much about what you're actually singing. It's like there are multiple times I'm sure you've experienced in your life where you're singing along to a song and then you're like, huh, that's sort of a weird lyric. You're just.
You're listening to Stats and Stories, and we're talking about the data behind some of your favorite, or at least some of the top hit songs, with Chris Della Riva.
Yeah, as you were talking about this, I was thinking about, with my kids, my daughter loved These Eyes by the Guess Who. That was sort of the song that really resonated. And in terms of the song Beast of Burden, you would think, well, what's that? Well, my son said, "Don't leave your pizza burning." So I mean, I think that the lyrics didn't matter so much as the tune that was there. Now, one thing I love about what you've provided as a resource is the data set of all of your ratings and songs. So naturally, I had to go in and use it and read it. So I went in, and one of the things that I thought I would do is look at just the number of times that all three of the raters agreed. And which songs were kind of the stars of the lowlights and then stars of the highlights. And
Yeah.
so and I thought that, the ones that where you all rated tens, there were some really, really great ones there. I mean, Me and Bobby McGee, but also Stayin' Alive. Yeah. were kind of top there, but there were only two that made it to the kind of consistently hated, in terms of the and do you they and the one was The Streak,
Yes.
and the second one was the Itsy Bitsy Teeny Weeny Yellow Polka Dot Bikini. Although I suspect it wasn't, then following that was Torn Between Two Lovers and Alone Again, Naturally. So I thought, that was a I found that affirming, that I thought, okay, I had some validation for my own biases. So can you talk about kind of those where you joined? I mean, only 86 out of 1177, which kind of reinforces your comment about how subjective it is in terms
Yeah,
of appreciating music.
totally. The directions I would give people when I told them to rate songs, I would say listen to it at least twice, even if you're familiar with the song. And well, listen, even if you're familiar with the song, listen to it at least twice, and just be fair in your rating, in the sense that if you don't like Bon Jovi, don't just automatically give every number one hit by Bon Jovi a one. Try to be somewhat fair about what you're doing. And I think you see that with something like Stayin' Alive by the Bee Gees. If you put it on and it's a song everyone's heard a gazillion times, to the point where it's basically impossible to rate some of these songs or to listen with fresh ears. But if you sit down and listen to something like that, I mean, the whole song works in a million different ways, and it's got a great bass line. It's an infectious song, and I think everyone really connected with that and was able to step back and be like, all right, this is an incredible composition. And in the same sense, we would get occasionally on the other end of the spectrum to be like, wow, this is horrendous. I do feel like there was some bias on everyone's part against what I'll call novelty songs. The Streak is a good example, and I think Itsy Bitsy Teeny Weeny Yellow Polka Dot Bikini, in that they're sort of built around a joke of sorts. The Streak is about streaking, which was weirdly a trend in the 1970s. So it's like, were we too harsh on something like that when it was clearly sort of made as a joke? Maybe, but I would never force someone to, or I would never try to subject someone to listening to The Streak for pleasure.
What a strange way to put them.
One thing that was a lot of fun in going through the book were all the figures there that you were using to help describe some of the data patterns that you saw. So a couple that I thought was interesting. You also did the same chart with different eras ending them a couple of times. Two times you did that. One was with the revenue of the music industry and sonic similarity, were the two cases that you ended up showing, where the music industry was at one point, and then later on there was an uptick in some of the revenue that was being generated. And then with sonic similarity, there were sort of other similar trends. Can you talk a little bit about the idea of music industry revenue over the eras that you observed?
Yeah, that's one of the most fascinating charts. And all the charts were made by my friend Kaylee Nerney, who was the book would not be the same without her. That data on revenue comes from the RIAA, which is the Recording Industry Association of America. And I love looking at that chart because it shows revenue by all different formats over the years. So you can see the rise and fall of the cassette and the rise and fall of the CD and the rise of streaming. What's interesting is that from the 1980s up to like 2000, music industry revenues go through the roof, and it's mostly because of the CD. Basically, you had to rebuy your whole music collection if you owned it on cassette or vinyl as a CD. And this was, the music industry's great tricks is every couple years they would roll out a new format and people would have to rebuy the same music over and over again. At the same time, CDs were very expensive, like to the point where you were probably paying more for a single CD than you would pay for an entire month of your music streaming subscription. So, you multiply that out and you see how the industry was making so much money. But at the same time, there was also some price fixing going on in the CD market. I mentioned this in passing. So prices were sort of illegally high, and there was a settlement in the early 2000s around this. But the industry is making tons and tons of money. This is like, fly someone out on a private jet just to come meet someone at the label that you clearly did not need the private jet ride for. But right around 2000, these as it reaches its peak, its all-time peak, revenues collapse. And the reason for this is this company called Napster rolled out, which, if you're of age, you'll certainly remember Napster. It was a file sharing service. You could effectively download music illegally. And naturally, this became very, very popular. Part of the reason I think it became popular was because CDs were so expensive. And back in the day, you could buy a single song, but in the CD era, labels stopped doing that. So if you wanted one song by, I don't know why I always use this as an example, the Bare Naked Ladies had a song in the late 90s called One Week that was very popular. But if it wasn't released as a single, you had to buy the whole album just to get access to that song. And suddenly this company, Napster, comes along where it's like, oh, I could just grab a single song. Of course, you're not paying. So that was an issue in itself. But I think the music industry sort of backed themselves into a corner here where they were really taking advantage of listeners to some degree. Revenues collapse. The industry tries to fight this by rolling out digital download stores like iTunes, but still, revenues collapse for about 10 years, 15 years, and it only starts to recover when streaming rolls out. And there's tons of controversy around how artists are paid in the streaming world, but at the very least, with the rise of streaming, there is money to be made in music again in a way that there really wasn't in the 2000s. So yeah, I mean I love that chart because you could sort of see the history of the last 50 years in it, and it's nice to look at it over time.
I think that dovetails really neatly into the question that I was trying to ask before I got sidetracked, because you mentioned early how the top 100 was determined very early, right? But we're in this moment where the technology is all different, how we're using and consuming media is different, how we're buying it. I pay for an Apple Music subscription and buy albums for fun to collect them, not the way I would have bought CDs in high school to have the music, you know?
Yeah.
And so how are they determining what the Hot 100 is now, given this media landscape?
Yes, yeah, I think this is actually an interesting statistical question because it's the Hot 100 is the same in name, but it's really not it's not measuring the same thing as it was. Back in the day, you were mostly measuring purchases. Radio was in there too, but for the most part, you could think of it. We're measuring sales data. What are people leaving their house and going to buy? Music is still purchased today, as you just mentioned. And there's even been like a resurgence of vinyl, but I think it's more not for listening, but just something to own. Where they do surveys of young people buying vinyl, and some of them don't even own record players. It's just something to put on the wall. But the chart is mostly determined now by streaming, and streaming is not purchased based on purchases, it's based on actual consumption. If you wanted consistent data over the last 60 years, it would not be how many people purchased I Want to Hold Your Hand by the Beatles. It would be how many people went home and how many times did they actually listen to that record. Billboard does its best to try to ultimately figure out what's the most popular song in this given week, but it's measuring it in completely different ways these days. Now it's mostly based on consumption, whereas in the past it was based on sales. And as I'm sure you know from your history buying CDs, I'm sure there were CDs you purchased that you listened to one time or you didn't even listen to at all. Whereas now that would not count towards the chart because it's all about listening. Whereas back then, once you walked out of the record store, no one knew what you did with your music.
I really enjoyed seeing how the construction of music has changed. Who was writing music has changed over time. You have some descriptions of the percentage of number one hits by a black solo artist or a group with at least one black member. You also have other figures describing kind of the number of hits, number one hits with at least one woman songwriter. And there've been just dramatic changes over time.
Yeah, I think this was something I wanted to make sure that the book got at because I think when people hear you're writing about music, especially popular music, it's like, well, that's pop songs are things you hear on, they're silly, the silly little things you hear on the radio, they're playing in the background of the supermarket, whatever. But I think what always fascinates me is popular music usually is illustrative of much larger trends. You're getting at some demographic trends, which I think are important, whereas In the 1960s, of course, you have the civil rights movement, and right around the same time, you start to see more black artists cross over to the pop charts in the US. A lot of that at that time was connected to the rise of Motown. And I think people underrate the importance of in race relations on more black artists or black celebrities being present in the American consciousness. By the 90s, I mean, the charts are often dominated. There's more black. I mean, if you're just breaking things down, black versus white, I try to keep demographics simple, and I acknowledge that in the book is like I can't keep track of every small difference in racial composition or gender composition. But in broad strokes, by the 90s, the charts are dominated by black artists. Women at this point, in terms of gender on the artist side, there's pretty much parity between men and women as artists. There's less parity when you get into production, songwriting, and if you go even more technical, like those are still fields that are heavily dominated by men. And that's something that I also wanted to highlight is, of course, there's been tremendous social progress since the start of the Hot 100, but you still see women seem to be systemically excluded to some degree from certain in certain places. Songwriting, production come to mind. So I wanted to get at how popular song, again, is illustrative of larger, seemingly more important things related to gender and racial equality and stuff like that.
So Chris, you've listened to just almost 1,200 songs. You've spent 3+ years of listening, countless more years of writing, and you derive some musical truths, including popular music is neither created nor destroyed, it evolves. Then secondly, let enough time pass and musical ideas that are out of fashion will become fashionable again. And the third is if somebody derides a musical element or tradition as, quote, not real music, end quote, they inevitably like a song that utilizes that element or some variation of it. And I thought those were, it was really interesting to think that you boiled down kind of your experience in this process to these observations. What was kind of the biggest surprise in this project? And maybe it's reflected in one of these truths, or maybe it's reflected in something else.
I came to appreciate much more music through this journey and realizing tons of biases that I had in my music listening and how I thought about music. And I tried to boil, I think, ways that I changed down to those three truths at the end. And I could give you sort of an example of each. When I say music evolves, it doesn't start and stop. That goes back to that idea of musical eras. It's on December 31st, 1979, everyone wasn't like, all right, the 70s are over, let's start something new. There's a continuation on January 1st, 1980, and we should be aware of that things change slowly over time. It's very, very rare that someone flips a switch and everyone's behavior changes. The second one about musical ideas sort of being recycled over time is people eventually usually look back to the past for inspiration, and sometimes the past becomes cool again. I feel like right now the 1980s are really in vogue in terms of there's a really synthy sound in popular music, and we've seen that idea come up again. But earlier we were talking about teenage tragedy songs. We have not seen the teenage tragedy song come back, but there was a grimness in popular song over the last decade that I think harkens back to that era. So I know people say like something like the past doesn't repeat itself, but it rhymes. And that was something that I observed again and again throughout the journey. And the last one about if you try to say something's not real music, usually you like something that utilizes whatever that element is. And this is something I came to appreciate again and again. An example I talk about is in the 60s, it was a big thing like, oh, the Monkees, we can't take them as seriously because they were made for a television show and they don't write their own music. But there were tons of artists that don't write their own music that people take just as seriously. I point to Frank Sinatra as a good example. He was not a composer, but most people aren't listening to Frank Sinatra and being like, oh, this isn't serious music because he didn't compose it. And I would just see this again and again throughout the decades. When new musical technology emerges, there's often some backlash against it, and then it becomes accepted. And you realize that art is just tremendously varied, and the artistic process is going to use whatever's available to it. And we shouldn't immediately just be like, oh, that's not right because it doesn't involve an electric guitar. Because decades before, there was probably some debate about electric guitars and how they were not the right way to make music. So I just try to I tried to keep these things in mind, or I learned to keep them in mind, because you just realize how wide and varied the musical world is.
That's all the time we have for this episode of Stats and Stories. Chris, thank you so much for being here again.
Yeah, thanks, Chris.
Thanks for having me. It's a ton of fun.
Stats and Stories is a partnership between the American Statistical Association and Miami University's Departments of Statistics and Media, Journalism, and Film. You can follow us on Spotify, Apple Podcast, or other places where you find podcast. If you'd like to share your thoughts on the program, send your email to statsstories@amstat.org or check us out at statsandstories.net. And be sure to listen for future editions of Stats and Stories, where we discuss the statistics behind the stories and the stories behind the statistics.